Welcome into a Sunday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We are going to be talking Jason Kidd and Rod Thorn getting into the Hall of Fame, the Nets' ferocious victory over the Miami Heat, and then the Nets flopping against the Detroit Pistons. A packed weekend of Nets basketball. Let's get to it.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome into the Locked On Nets podcast. I'm Gavin Shaw, your host. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I moved back to my native New York to cover the Brooklyn Nets, and I'm joined by the mystery man, Josh Bass. Nobody knows what he does except watch Nets basketball. I was at an excellent Passover dinner at his house Friday night. Josh,
dinner.
Got to sing some fun songs, hang out with some fellow Stuyvesant High School alumni. It was really a great night, and the food was excellent.
Yeah, you made quite the impression on my family. We're quite curious as to kind of what your entire deal was after.
Is that how they phrased it? I think I know Mitch loved me. Mitch was there for all of it.
Yeah, he's a character.
I don't think I was that much more out there than Marcus was. I think maybe a little later on after the Manischewitz hit me, but pre that, I think I was there.
Yeah, we'll talk offline about this.
Okay, all right. I had a lot of fun is the bottom line. And then just a great weekend of sports. Final Four games weren't that great, but it was cool to watch. And then Notre Dame winning the women's national title just a few hours ago. I was watching it interspersed with the Nets-Pistons game. Incredible Final Four. Shout out to Adam Amin. Great job broadcasting that. And then a really eventful couple days for the Nets. This was a big miss on my part. I totally neglected to mention because it was like an hour before we recorded the podcast. But Jason Kidd, Rod Thorn, both getting in to the Hall of Fame. Obviously, Kidd, the signature Net of your lifetime, Josh, and Thorn, the guy who helped put those two title teams together. So pretty cool, given everything the Nets have gone through the last few years, to see those two guys get some well-deserved recognition.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe I'm wired a bit differently, but I don't really care about individual admiration for players on my team. But I never really care about All-Star games, awards, Hall of Fame, things like that. Doesn't get me going. I don't know.
Yeah, you're just a different type of man.
Yeah, I'm solely W's and L's.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I think at some point this offseason we could do a deep dive podcast, maybe on both or one of them or separately, and maybe something on Jason Kidd's career or something how Rod Thorn, just like the history of them constructing those two title teams. I kind of wanted to do that last offseason, but we were just getting our feet under us. And before we knew it, we had to kind of get into player and team preview stuff. But this offseason, we're obviously going to have a lot more time, be a little bit more active. So that's something I'm kind of interested in doing. If you are, Josh, I'm sure we'll talk more about that. All right. Nets Heat, the Nets coming back from a 14-point deficit in quarter number one to win that one 110-109. It was a fun game, and I know it was choppy at points and chippy. There was a lot of physicality on both ends, and that obviously we'll get to Quincy Acey's fight with Andre Drummond, but that carried over to the next game. But this was a really fun game for me, and it was cool to see the Nets continue to have some fight. And again, it's been a rare occurrence in the second half of the year actually win two games in a row, and they continue to have the Miami Heat's number this entire season.
Yeah, 3-1 against the Heat. It definitely was a chippy game, a lot of loose balls going on both sides. I really think that these teams are pretty evenly matched from a talent perspective. I mean, obviously Dragic is a really good orchestrator of the Heat offense, but besides that, it seems that the teams are pretty similar.
Yeah, I guess you could argue Whiteside is a separating factor. I don't know. I'd say like yeah, he wasn't that good, and then he was. I wonder, I'm sure you read about, he got really mad after the game that they didn't play him at crunch time. Do you think they should have had him in there against the Nets going small, or would, the Nets have, torched him? Because generally, when teams playing the Nets have gone big, and the Nets have kept a five-man who could shoot out there, it's tended to hurt the Nets more than it's hurt the other team.
I think that because Quincy Acey and Dante Cunningham were shooting the three pretty well, I think they combined for about 5 of 8 on threes. It was enough to really disrupt Whiteside from being out there, because he's not someone that's really going to leave the paint at all. So it makes sense to have a quicker lineup in with a James Johnson type of center.
Yeah. Oh, Acey was a guy who was shockingly good in this game. 13 points in 14 minutes. Hadn't really played much in about 3 weeks, and then just comes off the bench and was absolutely scorching. I want to highlight his performance, but first, I think we should talk about Caris LeVert, because to me, he was the guy really responsible with the Nets winning this game. On that last defensive stand with about 31 seconds left, or I guess it was before Dragic's last shot, but there's 30 seconds left. The game is tied. And it was actually extremely reminiscent of the LeBron block in Game 7 of the 2016 Finals. And I obviously, like, the situation wasn't the same. But it was really, like the exact same sequence, with Justice Winslow kind of being ahead of the pack. Alan Crabb playing the role of J.R. Smith to sprint down the court and make a great hustle play to at least delay Winslow for a second. And Winslow kind of ducks him, but then opens the door for LeVert to have this incredible flying block. And that ultimately, because the Nets didn't score again, that proved to have saved the game. And then LeVert takes over in overtime. He torches Dwayne Wade on a play, which was just, I mean, obviously Wade isn't the same guy he was, but it was just cool to watch. So I give LeVert, who finished with 19 points, 12 rebounds, and 8 assists, a lot of credit for this victory. And those two plays kind of stood out in my mind.
Yeah, he did a great job in the fourth quarter and overtime, hitting really tough, contested mid-range shots and floaters. And I think we've seen from him where he's usually great going to the basket, obviously, and he can get a blow-by, especially on a switch, but he often struggles to hit that intermediate shot. And he was really showing that last night. Didn't necessarily carry over to the game against Detroit, but it's a good sign to see nonetheless.
You know, his ability, I mean, I don't know, I've said it a million times this year, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but his ability to adjust around the rim continues to amaze me, and I think he's getting better and better at it. Like I don't want to go too much between the two games, because we're going to talk about them separately. But in that Pistons game, the play where D'Lo threw a fast break outlet pass to him, and it took like one extra bounce, and it seemed like it was going to take him out of the play, and he's going to have to bring it out. And then he picks up the ball, does like the Rondo fake behind his back, and then goes up and under, and somehow does it all without traveling. Was just really, really cool.
No, he traveled. They just didn't
Yeah, no, he did. I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, he kind of shuffled his feet. But anyway, I mean, just like plays like that, like his ability to like hang, and like also like maybe even more impressive than the finishes are some of the passes he throws where he just loops around two or three guys. Like it is like, it's sacrilegious to say this, but like it is like almost like obviously it doesn't get the same hang time, but it's kind of like Jordan-esque, and like just like the multiple like ball fakes in the air. And I don't know, you don't see like two, like I'm sure like plenty of guys in the league have the athleticism to pull off similar stuff, but you just don't see too many guys have like the coordination and like the confidence to do it consistently. So I'm just wondering like when LeVert continues to develop a more diverse offensive game in terms of his ball handling and jabs and pivots and pacing, like I just think he's going to be deadly on offense. And like to me, like he continues to be a guy that really excites me despite the inconsistency.
He's definitely an exciting player. I think for him, the biggest factor is going to be, can he keep developing that outside shot? Can he hit threes off the dribble? I mean, he's a decent shooter off the catch right now. Obviously, that needs to continue to improve, but hitting, being able to hit threes off the dribble will really be a big differentiator for him. But I feel like we can't really spend more time in this game without talking about the we can't beat around the bush anymore, the burning bush in Passover. That's D'Angelo Russell getting benched, because I didn't watch the game live, but when I first found that out, I was pretty shocked.
Yeah, no, it was weird. I mean, is he like, he opened the game and he was playing decently seemingly, but then there were just a lot of breakdowns. Like he committed like two or three turnovers in a stretch of 5 possessions. And the most frustrating thing was just he's a bad defender on his best day. But it was just like he's half asleep. Like there was a play where Goran Dragic just took the inbounds on a sideline on a baseline send-in, like it was off a basket, and D'Lo just assumes that Kelly Olynyk on like his far left is going to set a screen for him, and he literally just lets Dragic stroll down the lane for a layup like 4 plays in. And to me, like that, I, like at least in my mind, like maybe I'm off about this, but that was the play that probably sent the message to Kenny Atkinson, all right, he's just not ready to play tonight. And it was like kind of disheartening to see just like that total lack of focus for him to start this one. But we always complain, I mean, you specifically, about like Atkinson's lack of in-game adjustments. Like, I like the fact that he kind of stood up for the fact that, like, you know what, we're trying to win games. Like, I know at this point in the season, a lot of the goals are developmental, but I'm not going to tolerate anyone, even if it's D'Angelo Russell, who's, like, theoretically, like, the prize of this Nets roster, playing below their talent level and not giving enough effort. And I'm going to send a message by taking him out for this game. And I think it made all the difference because Spencer Dinwiddie, even though he didn't shoot it well, did a fabulous job managing this game. And I think that was the reason they won.
Well, you can argue that D'Lo is playing to his talent level, but that's a whole other point.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he just wasn't playing with a lot of effort. Horrible shot selection. Not necessarily, I think that's out of the usual for him, but Atkinson, I guess, had enough. And I'm honestly proud of him that he did. And I think, as you mentioned, Dinwiddie did a really good job controlling the pace of the game. Obviously, LeVert at the end was really great in terms of taking over. So they didn't really miss him at all. We just hope that he gets the message moving forward, because game against Detroit tonight was a lot of the bad habits that we normally see from him.
All right, we'll come back, talk about Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's battle with Bloodsport and Jared Allen picking it up at the end of the season. That up next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. The Brooklyn Nets, a 110-109 win over the Miami Heat. And quick talk on Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's performance. He was another guy who helped the Nets win this game. 20 points, 14 rebounds, and I love the toughness for him. He was going back and forth with James Johnson, a.k.a. Bloodsport, a.k.a. A black belt in karate, and they had a good battle. Like, Johnson, like, one time, like, nearly got into a fight with Hollis-Jefferson because he hit him in the neck on a drive, and there was no foul called, so Hollis-Jefferson was obviously upset. But I like how Rondae, like, kept his composure, came back at him, and, like, eventually, I don't want to give him full credit for winning the Nets the game, because obviously, we were just saying Caris LeVert was a big part of that, but I thought his play and, like, his toughness really helped make the difference down the stretch in this one.
Yeah, I mean, he had a 20-14 game, and I think those types of efforts are something that's become a big commonplace for him. So, he's really had a significant improvement this year. I think he's probably the person you point to under the Kenny Atkinson regime that's really been able to develop. And I think it's great to see. I mean, I don't know if he's ever going to be a consistent starter on a good team, but definitely someone that's good to have around.
Yeah, and that's like, I mean, like, I don't want to get too big picture, because we don't want this to be like an hour podcast, but that's like, oh, that's constantly what I'm thinking about with the Nets these days. And it's just like, all right, like, you have all these guys that are solid, and, like, it usually adds up to, like, close wins or more often close losses. And, like, but, like, like, at some point, and, like, obviously this is kind of, like, I mean, it's year two of Kenny Atkinson, but year one of Sean Marks really having a chance to mold the team, like, which these guys are going to pop. And we were saying Caris LeVert has that chance. Jared Allen is a guy who really picked it up. But I'm so curious to, like, what the direction of the team is going to be this offseason, like, whether it's, like, kind of maintaining the status quo and let's let these guys grow, or, like, or do we finally have our own pick? Do we blow it up and try and get bad to get someone really good? And, like,
I don't think they need to blow it up to get bad, though.
Well, yeah, they're already happen. Right, but I mean, like, I guess, like, if you kept everyone together, like, would they be, like, projected next year to be, like, the 8th worst team in the NBA, the 9th worst team in the NBA? Like, I was just saying, like, if you wanted to get, like, a top 3 pick. And I guess the lottery structure is changing after this year, so maybe that'll help the Nets. I can't remember exactly how it works right now, but I don't know. I'm interested to see, because right now you just, like, I don't know about you, Josh, but, like, even though all these guys are young, you just get the feeling, like, that, like, there's, like, just, like, a ceiling on this team. And again, like, it's stupid to get big picture, because we have no idea what they're going to do this offseason. But it's just something I think about when I see guys like Hollis-Jefferson, like, playing well, but, like, I don't know if he's, as you said, I don't know if he's a starter on, like, a really good team.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we're going to see probably more next season, like, trying to figure some things out, because the core is still trying to build together, and who knows if it's going to be the core years from now, because, as you mentioned, there is no star player on the team. A collection of guys that have potential to be really good, but who knows if they're ever going to reach that ceiling. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see the direction of this team in the offseason. I could see Marks kind of trying to take some of the ancillary pieces, like a Damari Carroll, or I don't even know who else would be, kind of Spencer Dinwiddie, and then seeing if what they can get those assets for those guys, and then just trying to be horrible next year and give D'Lo 40 minutes a game and let him lead them to 16 wins or something like that.
I think you'd quit the podcast in that scenario. I don't know if you could stomach 40 minutes of D'Lo a night.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So for your sake, we'll hope that doesn't happen. All right. Interesting conversation, one that will continue into the offseason. Next game, the one that just happened, the Detroit Pistons knocking off the Brooklyn Nets 108-96. Kind of a listless effort for the Nets. I thought they had moments where they were playing pretty well in the first quarter. Particularly, I liked that D'Angelo Russell came out with some fire after getting benched. And then it was like a weird, like 13-0 run for the Pistons in the second quarter that separated them and essentially ended this game with a full half to go. And it just felt like the Nets like didn't have any energy, didn't give a crap, didn't really want to be there. And the Pistons were playing for a desperation shot or a shot in the dark at the playoffs, which isn't going to happen. But I don't know. It was kind of a depressing, boring game that you felt like, I don't know. Maybe you felt differently, Josh, but for me, like with like 4 minutes left in the second quarter, I was like, all right, like I could literally not watch the rest of this game and I can tell you how the rest of it's going to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think when Ish Smith scored 17 points from 7-of-7 shooting,
Suns legend.
Half, the third shot he hit, fine. Fourth shot, okay, now something needs to happen. Hit, six, seven. But just like there was no adjustment going on. D'Angelo Russell wasn't trying to change pick and roll strategy. Atkinson wasn't trying to do anything to alter it. And Ish Smith is going to go off on you if you let him do that and you let him get it into a rhythm. And it was just pathetic to watch that happen. And I think from there, the Nets obviously had some moments in early in the fourth quarter, but they couldn't hit shots to really make it a 4 or 5 point game from 8 or 9. And from there, they weren't going to come back, even without Andre Drummond.
Yeah. And, yeah, Drummond, obviously, yeah, you know, we could start there, because that to me was kind of the signature moment in the game. Drummond getting into a fight with Quincy Acey. I didn't really quite see what started it off. Like, to me, like, the first thing I saw was, and it must have been something on the box out, because Acey just kind of threw him at, like a half punch, half elbow to the chest, and then Drummond said something, and then Acey stepped up, and then Drummond had this flinch that Nets Twitter was really making fun of him. And you always get the feeling with, like, I mean, there's some seven-footers that are legitimately really tough and really scary, and you would never really want to mess with them. I've always got the feeling that Drummond is more in the Dwight Howard mold, where he's kind of like a little kid inside a giant body. And there's, like, nothing wrong with that, but you could tell, like, even though, yeah, AC was giving up 5 inches, AC was kind of the intimidator there, but then obviously they go chest-to-chest, and, like, Drummond says something that makes AC really mad to the point that he, like, hits an official in the shoulder. And it could have been a lot worse, because like AC, like, it obviously, like, it wasn't intentional. Like, he didn't know who was grabbing him. He was just trying to get away and get at Drummond. But like, if he had hit the guy in the face, that would have been awful as it is. Like, I'm assuming there's going to be some kind of suspension for him.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, good job by AC to bite the bullet and get Drummond out of the game. I think where the scrum started from was when Drummond got a rebound. There was about 4 Nets around him. He loses the ball to the floor, and I think something happened there where AC tried to grab for it, and they got tangled up. And yeah, I don't know. Drummond's like, I feel like he's just like a punching bag of everyone. Like, no one really respects him too much because of all the stuff, like with his free throws and shoulder hair. And
also Sam from iCarly denying.
Yeah, Jeanette McCurdy.
Yeah.
Or she actually swerved him, I think. But yeah, he's just like, I don't know. I feel like I kind of feel bad for him. Like, him and Reggie Jackson kind of hate each other from what I've heard. So I think just like AC getting in space, he has kind of had enough.
Doesn't everyone kind of hate Reggie Jackson? That was like the whole thing with the Thunder, that like just like no one liked him.
Yeah, well, I think everyone in Detroit hates him also. They all love
Ish Smith. He's like one of those guys that's like an objectively like a good player. Like he dropped 29 on the Nets tonight. Like, floater game really strong, good at getting to the basket, good at getting fouled. But he doesn't seem like he's like fun to play with in the slightest.
He's a drain on the team in the process, even though he's putting up stats.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you there. All right, we will break down the rest of this Nets-Pistons game, including some great performances from the Pistons role players, and Jared Allen finishing the season on a good note, continuing to look explosive, all that and more up next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. The Nets fall to the Detroit Pistons tonight, 108-96. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass with you. And yeah, we were just talking about Andre Drummond going face to face with Quincy Acey. And that was certainly the most exciting thing to happen in the game from a basketball perspective. It was that Pistons run in the second quarter. The Nets able to cut it to 6 with 2:20 left. And then an absolute just bailout foul from Caris LeVert on Reggie Jackson with under a second left on the shot clock. He fouls Jackson on a fading three that Jackson was never going to make. Jackson comes back. I think he hit all three of his free throws, and then that was the game.
Yeah, I mean, the Nets just couldn't cut it to within six or seven. It's a combination of missing open shots. They were 12 of 43 from three, and there was a series of three or four in a row where Damari Carroll, Joe Harris, I think Caris LeVert had wide open looks, so he just couldn't connect on them. So it's a make or miss league, Gavin.
Mm. Wise words. Now, and the thing, like, the whole thing was, like, they had every opportunity to come back in the fourth quarter. Like, the Pistons also had, like, a stretch where they missed eight shots in a row, and that's how, like, the Nets scoring, like, 6 points over, like, an eight-minute stretch where we were able to still cut into the deficit. But it just, it was a little bit of, it was too little too late, I guess. I don't know. This game was, like, it was just one of those, like classic, like, we're out of it, we don't really care, let's finish up the season. The one bright spot for me was Jared Allen. Like, I thought the last two or three games, Kenny Atkinson had that comment about him hitting the rookie wall, and it seems like he's broken through it, which is really encouraging to me, because one of my biggest questions about Allen was, could he physically hold up in the NBA over a full season? And obviously, I think he had two stretches this year where he missed games with minor injuries, but never really had that sustained stretch where he had to go out, and he's been able to be a consistent force for them down the stretch and still finishing with some high-flying slams game after game after game. I mean, just the sheer fact that he still has his legs under him and he's still making plays at the rim on both ends, it, to me at least, is really encouraging.
Yeah, and he hit a corner three tonight.
Oh, that was awesome.
I was very happy when he hit that. He also did a pretty good job at the rim. I think he blocked three shots, affected a ton more. He was a pretty good presence at the rim. I mean, it's tough for him when the Nets guards are just letting Reggie Jackson or Ish Smith or whomever have a free lane to the center of the court. But he did a good job, all things considered.
Yeah. And then, I definitely agree with that. I thought he was good around the basket. My other thing in this game was it was the same thing as I think it was the Magic game where Spencer Dinwiddie only played 12 minutes after, again, he hasn't shot the ball well for months, so that's not even on the table. But after a game where I thought he just managed the game fabulously against the Miami Heat, he just doesn't even really get an opportunity to play in the second half. And if D'Angelo Russell was going off, if Caris was going off, I'd say, sure, that's fine, let those two go. But those two combined to shoot 9 of 25 from the field. Russell, after a really strong first quarter where he made some brilliant passes, and I thought he really was the reason the Nets offense got off to a pretty solid start. He totally fell apart both ends. You mentioned it, Ish Smith completely roasting him. Caris had some nice moments, really good passing the ball. He was the best of the three, but not that great in his own right. I don't know. I would have tried Dinwiddie at some point in the second half. He's a guy who's at his best when he can get into a rhythm, when he can feel the ball, and when he can kind of attack and set up his teammates. And I really don't think he had that opportunity tonight. So I guess that was my frustration with Atkinson for the night.
I think I have a problem with it because the Nets were so listless, and I think down by 20 at the point where they would have put Dinwiddie in, just try something different. So Stauskas came in, got his time, hit a three. And I think the LeVert, Stauskas, Harris lineup, there was something there. And obviously, it's not something you're going to go to often, but against a Detroit team that's pretty devoid of talent, especially without Blake Griffin, I think it was worth trying. Because there's no harm in kind of getting Stauskas the minutes. Dinwiddie, we kind of know what he is at this point. And while I think he's pretty good, I don't really have a problem with Stauskas getting some runs.
Yeah, no, and that's not unfair, but I mean, I guess my issue is, like, I continue to not really believe D'Angelo Russell has earned the right to get those minutes over Spencer Dinwiddie, and I get statistically he's been superior, but I think, I don't know, to me, they're better when Dinwiddie's out there, and I think stats...
I don't think anyone can argue that. I feel like no one really... Russell's case isn't a statistical thing, it's not an advanced metrics thing, it's just that he has the pedigree of being the second overall pick and someone that the Nets traded the pick that became Kyle Kuzma and Brook Lopez, the franchise's all-time leading scorer for. So they're going to give him every chance to succeed. Even though I don't think he can do it, he still needs the opportunity to try.
Yeah, no, and that's fair. And again, like, the Nets season is long over at this point, at least in terms of any playoff aspirations or winning or hitting a certain mark of wins. Like, that's not going to happen. So I again, on paper, it makes total sense. But to me, like, I'm always a guy who has issues with the best player not being out there, especially when Dinwiddie, I mean, he could be part of the future of the franchise, and he's only 24, even if they don't have quite the investment in him that they have in D'Angelo Russell. All right, I'm trying to think. Any final thoughts on this one? The only other thing I'd say is, yeah, sorry, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that I just really want to highlight how good Russell was in the first 4 minutes of the game.
He was awesome, yeah.
Making really quick, accurate passes. Wasn't looking to score, but just did a great job of taking apart the defense. And then it seems like when he's like, okay, now I've had 3 or 4 assists, really gotten everyone in the flow, now I'm going to try to score. And then it just took everyone out of their rhythm, and he was horrible.
Yeah, and he opened the game with a really nice defensive play, and I was like, it wasn't like, oh, he's finally getting it, because it was just such a small moment. But those 4 minutes, like, told me, like, I just thought he was going to have a great game. He was going to go out there. He's going to kick some ass. He's going to lead the Nets to a win. And it would have been the type of performance that I think, in my mind, and a lot of Nets fans' mind, could have kind of started to turn things around and allowed him to end the season on a really high note. And, like, for the people who think he started really well, it would have been kind of a good way to bookend the year. But he just didn't end up having it. So we're going to have to see if he can turn that around down the stretch. This is completely non-Nets related, but my other takeaway in this game was I kind of think the Pistons might be better without Blake Griffin. And it's kind of the story of the second half of Griffin's career, or I guess you could say after that Spurs series, where I think he peaked as a player, where the ongoing question is, like, Griffin, like, is clearly, like, a fabulous talent, and even diminished a little bit, he's still, I think, one of the top 30 to 40 players in the NBA. But the fact that, and it's not like he's a terrible three-point shooter, like, he's added that to his game a little bit, but if you put a true stretch four in that spot, like they did in Anthony Tolliver, who's not even in Blake Griffin's universe from a talent perspective, I feel like a team is nearly, or in this case, more effective than with Griffin out there, and it's just because of spacing and other guys getting touches and the floor being less clogged. But Josh, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that, because to me that's always kind of a fascinating phenomenon where a guy's clearly better than someone else, but just not as good of a fit, and that kind of adds up to him being less effective.
I think that Blake Griffin can still be really good surrounded by the right pieces, but as you mentioned, it is tough, and I think his best scenario would be like a point forward type, a Draymond Green-esque player, obviously not the defensive player that Green is, but he's definitely much more explosive offensively. The problem is with Detroit, they don't really have, at the point guard position, like people that can really spot up and knock down threes besides Blake Griffin, because it's Reggie Jackson, Ish Smith. Those guys need the ball in their hands. They're not really guys that can be low usage. But if he's surrounded by, let's say, a Patty Mills type, I think he could really thrive.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Like with Drummond and those guys around him, it's hard. Stanley Johnson, also not a knockdown three-point shooter. I mean, hey, Bullock and Kennard, who are both pretty good three-point shooters, but just the entire team, not great from beyond the arc.
Yeah, he'd be really good on the Spurs. I'd be kind of interested to see him on a team like the Bucks that has like enough length to compensate for the fact that he's not a rim protector. You could play him nominally at the five and use Giannis kind of as someone to guard a center. Like something like that would be interesting. Or even like if he was in Dario Saric's spot on the Sixers, like he could do a better version of what Saric is doing for them. There's a lot of interesting scenarios. The only problem is no one's ever going to trade for him because he's making $40 million in 4 years, and to some degree looks like he's over the hill a little bit. And this pains me to say because I'm, as you well know, Josh, I'm a University of Oklahoma fan, Blake Griffin, one of my favorite players of all time. But I just think this is going to end terribly for Detroit, and it was a trade kind of made by Stan Van Gundy to save his job, and I think it's going to go down as a quintessential example of why you don't let a coach also be the GM, because it's two different sets of priorities, and they clash here, and for a guy who was on the hot seat, he was doing anything he could to turn the ship around, but I think it's going to maybe burn Detroit's franchise for the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think honestly, what about the Lakers? I mean, it's not realistic, but like, I think a lineup of him, Kuzma, Brandon Ingram, Contavious Caldwell-Pope, Lonzo Ball would get burned on defense, but I think offensively, there's something there that could work. If Lonzo's a ball mover, he doesn't need to be like holding the ball the entire time. Ingram has the length to compensate. Kuzma is a knockdown shooter. I think there's something there.
No, that I'm with you. That'd be
interesting. Randall's spot.
I mean, like I think with like a really good coach, and like I'm not even saying like Detroit can obviously like reorganize around him. Like they can always trade Drummond. They could, if they get a really, really smart coach in there, they could maybe find a way to make him and Drummond work if you have three really, really talented perimeter shooters. But to me, I mean, again, like the bugaboo with all that is his contract, and he's not a guy I think you can really build around at this point in his career, and I'd love for him to prove me wrong because I love him. But it's that trade just looks, and it's incredible because it was a trade that happened 2 months ago. It just looks so bad, and I think I hate it. That I think Detroit fans who are so excited to get him are going to be like maybe cursing his name for years, and I don't think that's fair to Blake because he signed that contract under the expectation that he was going to be a Clipper for the rest of his life. And that's what the Clippers told him. And it's just one of those weird NBA things. And it shouldn't, and I guess like his whole premise in not asking for a no trade clause is that contract was seemingly, I mean, one, like it seems like the Clippers wouldn't have wanted to trade him, but even if they did, it seemed like it was untradeable. And like give the Clippers a little bit of credit for just being smart enough to audible right away when it seemed like it wasn't going to work and get back a really good player in my mind in Tobias Harris. So I know none of this is Nets related, but to me, that's just a very interesting NBA trade, and I think it's going to shape those two teams for years to come.
Yeah, no, there you go. I think it's something where most people around the league and followed the league closely understood that it was a pretty kind of short-sighted trade for Detroit at the time. Especially with them not going to be making the playoffs this year. It's really going to look bad.
All right. That's an awesome place for us to wrap up. The Brooklyn Nets. What is it, Josh? I think 6 games remaining, maybe 7. We're getting down the wire. They only have 5 left. Oh, my God. Wow. That's wild. All right, so next game is Tuesday. They go to Philadelphia. I know I was talking about the last few weeks of them getting one big-time win before the end of the season. Obviously, that one loses that element a little bit with Joel Embiid out, but I think it would still be a nice one for them to win. And then they go to Milwaukee, to Chicago, one more home game against the Bulls Monday, April 9th, and then to the Celtics to finish up the season. So we're in the stretch run.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is going to be – I think they'll probably be playing the Windy City Bulls because they want to lose so badly that game.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's funny to be Chicago. Like, I think they pretty much don't have anyone on the team, but maybe they'll be a little bit fired up because the Nets kicked them out of the playoffs. Next year, want to get revenge on the Nets, stop them from getting to 27 wins. I don't know. That could be pretty dramatic.
I feel like it's just Zipser and Robin Lopez that are still on that team.
Yeah, the two studs. All right. Oh, yeah. Oh, one a random note that I wanted to mention that I totally forgot to when we were talking about the Heat game, incredible Iron Eagle line, and he just said it so nonchalantly, no one else reacted to it, but Tyler Johnson just dribbling on the perimeter, and he's like, Tyler Johnson, no relation to James Johnson, and just like keeps going. I thought that was good. All right, good place to end this one. For Josh, I'm Gavin. We'll be back most likely Tuesday night, so look at your feeds Wednesday morning for the newest Locked On Nets podcast. Until then, be well.